This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte lost many of its older and historic buildings to the wrecking ball. Out with the old, in with the new. We've since recognized that as a mistake. Older buildings not only give a city character, but a sense of place. So Charlotte is trying not to make that same mistake again by turning its attention to mid-20th century architecture. Though many experts say now is the time to save our collection of mid-century buildings, getting people to believe that may prove difficult. After all, many folks don't see the historic value of structures they watched being built. So this hour, we delve into what makes mid-century architecture important, even historic, what buildings fit that description in Charlotte, and why now is the time to act on saving these structures. Dr. Theodore Pruden is a leading expert in the preservation of modern architecture and teaches preservation at Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. He's in town today to speak at UNC Charlotte later this afternoon. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
He's in our Spirit Square studio along with Diane Althaus, Executive Director of Historic Charlotte. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Ken Lambla is Dean of the College of Architecture at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Before we talk about specific buildings and before we get into the subject at large and define exactly what mid-century architecture is, I understand that Charlotte has the second largest collection of this style of architecture in the state. Who has the first largest collection? We like to be first here, you know.
It's commonly thought to be the Triangle area.
Okay.
The North Carolina State School of Design was founded 1940s, 1950s, mm-hmm. and as a result, a lot of those architects lived in the area and started building houses and started, you know, getting jobs in a growing area. And it has the largest collection from what we know right now.
Okay. So in the second, how far are we separated in terms of numbers of examples of buildings? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't have a number.
Dr. Pruden, you're an architect. You're a partner in an architectural restoration firm in New York City. You teach historic preservation. You're also the founding president of something called DOCOMOMO US, which is an acronym, I suppose, an abbreviation for the Documentation and Conservation of Building Sites and Neighborhoods of the Modern Movement. What led to all this? What is your personal interest in all of this?
Well, I think it's on different levels, but don't you love the name? Because I think everybody sort of remembers it, but doesn't quite remember it, and all sorts of different acronyms come out of it. But I think that the origin, it's an international organization. We are one of the 55 chapters worldwide on five continents. And my personal interest started because the people founded it were Dutch, which I am, and we're beginning to look at interwar modernism about 20 years ago. And as a result of that, that sort of migrated with time onwards to look much more, not only just before World War II, but particularly at the period after World War II.
You know, I knew nothing about this until yesterday when I started reading about this, and it actually fascinated me that this did start, this movement, this modernist movement, started in Europe.
Started in Europe with 13 countries getting together in about 1990, looking at a 1920s, TB sanatorium. Mm.
But also what fascinated me was that the style of architecture came from Europe.
I think what most Americans don't realize is that most of those people in the 1920s actually came to America to look at architecture. They went to Detroit. Everybody went to Detroit because Albert Kahn was the innovator of industrial processes of making architecture affordable, making cars affordable. Mm-hmm. So all these people came and looked at Detroit. And so if you look at factories in Rotterdam, they were here. They were here five times every time looking at how the process worked.
Hmm. You have said that there's a prejudice against modern architecture, which is related to our perception of what good architecture is. Explain that. Where does that prejudice come from?
I'm not even sure I remember the quote. But
trust me, you said it. Or maybe you were misquoted. I don't know.
No. I think the prejudice is because historically people looked at preservation as a craft-based kind of admiration for what was being done. And I think that the shift from that craft-based to a design-based culture is what, for most people, is still very hard to accommodate and to appreciate. And you know what the real irony is that our buildings live shorter and we live longer. Mm. And so we have two counter-cyclical movements whereby we actually are preserving the buildings we build ourselves. It's not our kids. It's us.
You're in the school of architecture, Dr. Lamb. He just talked about craft-based versus design-based buildings. And if you go to Europe, one of the charming things about cities like Paris and places like that is all the wonderful flourishes in the architecture that work took craftsmen years probably to create. And now this modern architecture takes all that away. It pares it down to the basically frame and windows in some of these buildings. Why is that interesting architecturally to somebody who studied it and is involved in it as a profession?
I think it has to do with a search for authenticity. There's a very famous essay written by Adolf Loos in 1910 that calls to arms architects to stop, well, frittering away the opportunity of building a city and expanding a city through ornamentation. And the essay's title is "Ornament is Crime." It's a kind of touchstone for a search for authenticity in terms of its social value, its construction and material essence, the emergence of new materials. Mm-hmm. And so to me, one of the real values of talking about this preservation of modern architecture is the authenticity that it represents.
It seems to me that we are moving away from this style of architecture. If you go to if you go down the street to Elizabeth Avenue to CPCC, mm-hmm. many of their buildings, and correct me if I'm wrong, many of their buildings started out in this form, minimalist, utilitarian, modern, right?
Yes, and the core of that campus is beautiful.
And they spent the better part of the last 5 years or 4 years bricking it up, man, making it look South Park. Not South Park, but the shops at Morrison and where the Harris Teeter is and that whole, I don't even know what you call that kind of architecture, but it seems to be sprouting up everywhere in Charlotte.
It's a facadism. I actually drove past it coming here to this morning, and it, in my opinion, is unfortunate in the sense that there's a conflict between the core mission of an educational institution or a manufacturing facility in which it's then the facade takes over. It's an over-reliance on image and not on the process of design.
But then is that because we live in an area that seems to like that style of architecture? And Dr. Pruden, you have said most people grow up with a preference for very traditional, classical style buildings. And that seems to be particularly true in this part of the country. We love colonial and Georgian architecture and things like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that. I think one of the comparisons I always make is that when people invented locomotives in the 1830s, they gave them Gothic details. And it was partially because of the discomfort with the machine itself. And I think in some ways, as a reaction to modernism, we may be actually into a period where there is the less of experiment, there is less positive. Because remember, it started after World War II. People came out of the war. There was an incredible sense that, one, it could be done. Secondly, they wanted to do it differently. And I think that part of optimism is maybe not there.
Hmm.
I realize this is sort of a complicated comment there, but I think there is part
of that. Let me see if I understand this. Coming out of World War II, particularly in Europe, where there was a great need to build, there was this sense of hope and optimism that was reflected in the architecture, and now we've lost that, and so we're putting facades up to shore up our image?
We've lost a sense of courage, to be sure.
Yeah.
Wow. Diane Althaus, we're with Historic Charlotte, and when we think about historic preservation generally in places like this and Alexandria, Virginia, and Georgetown and Washington, we think about saving old colonial homes and things that are even beyond that. In Charlotte, we've had Victorian homes being saved, etc. How does this fit into that?
Well, it fits in because there's actually a lot more of this kind of architecture in Charlotte than people realize. And, you know, you mentioned the Victorian homes, and you asked earlier, you know, why are we worried about this now? Because if we worry about it too late, like we did with a lot of the Victorian architecture in Charlotte, there'll be Fourth Ward, and there'll be a little bit of it and a few other houses scattered around the town. And if we can get folks to realize how beautiful these buildings are now, and I'm sure that people have driven by these houses and small office buildings and tall buildings many times and not thought much about it. Mm-hmm. But by hearing a program like this, they're going to start to realize this was a pretty prevalent building style right after World War II in Charlotte. Not all of them have survived, but there are some really great examples that have survived. So we're, you know, in preservation, sort of the worst thing that can happen is that 11th hour cry for, you know, help and to stop the wrecking ball. And if we start having this conversation now, as a lot of these buildings become 50-plus years old, which is generally considered, you know, the age at which you can landmark a building or put it on the National Register, we might do a much better job at preserving the tall buildings, the houses, et cetera.
As I said in the very beginning, a lot of people have difficulty seeing the historical significance of a building that they may have seen being built. Help us to understand the historical significance. Help us to see what it is you see in these buildings, because not all of them are worth preserving, let's be honest, correct?
Oh, I think that's true.
Okay. So what do you, in a building that is worth preserving, what is it that you see that we may not?
This, well, I think first I'd like to preamble this by saying there was a period of people hating Victorian architecture.
Yes.
And so let's not forget there is a motion of time, and that 30, 40 years ago, everybody disliked Art Deco, which is these days very hard to accept that was the case. But I think these buildings are significant for a wide variety of reasons. I think they're aesthetically, technically, socially sometimes, and all these factors come together making significance. Not that different, by the way, from Georgetown or any other place, because it's both the sense of place as well as the visual presence of it. And I think part of what happens in preservation is that we've been focused so much on the aesthetics of it and less on the total cultural value that it represents within the community because of where it is or what it did or who was there or whatever else.
So it's more than the architectural significance of it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important to understand is these buildings are uniquely Charlotte. Many of them were designed and built by Charlottean architects. Mm. And, you know, a lot of folks that have moved to Charlotte, which is a huge part of the population right now, first thing they'll say is, well, you know, what happened to Charlotte's history?
Right.
I don't see it the minute I walk down Tryon
Street. I've had that happen to me.
And I have it happen to me all the time because I'm executive director of Historic Charlotte. So I think what people need to realize is these different kinds of buildings are special to Charlotte. And it gives you, if you think about the different layers of architecture that you're going to see as you walk up and down Tryon Street or College Street or any of those streets in the city, it will tell you a little bit about what was happening at that period of time when the building was built.
Dr. Lambler, you wanted to chime in on this.
I think it's important to kind of provide some historic background to the architects themselves who were working in Charlotte in this period of time, because there's three architects that I think people need to really pay attention to. Close attention to. One is A.G. Odell, Gooley Odell. The second is Norman Pease, Colonel Pease. And the third is Jack Boyd. I think these are individuals. Gooley Odell grew up in Concord. He went away to school. He went to Cornell to go to school and came back to Charlotte in order to build a new South City. I think there was a sense of there was a sense of adventure, and there was a sense of cultural preparation. Norman Pease went to Auburn. Jack Boynt went to Georgia Tech. And they were all familiar with Black Mountain College, which was started in 1933. People think of Black Mountain College far too often as an art and architectural event, but it was really grounded in educational theory as a pedagogy for learning. And that learning was not specific or not only art and architecture, but it was a very broad platform.
We'll come back to that. We have to take a break. That's Dr. Ken Lamlin, Dean of the College of Architecture at UNC Charlotte. Also with us, Diane Althaus with Historic Charlotte, and Dr. Theodore Prudhomme. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Saab of Charlotte, introducing Saab's 9.3X Sport Wagon, which features heightened ground clearance, turbocharged engine, and cross-wheel drive for all-weather traction and control. Saab, move your mind. And the Charlotte School of Law, with full-time day and evening part-time JD programs, hosting an information session Wednesday, November the 10th at 6, registration at charlottelaw.edu/evening-pt. Well, John Feinstein is a prolific sports writer whose work often examines the impact of sports on society, and he appears frequently here on NPR, and two of his books are bestsellers. He's going to talk with us about sports in general and about scandals in baseball, alleged violations elsewhere, LeBron James' controversial move to Miami, and more in a conversation we had at Lenoir Ryan University back in September, and that is tomorrow at 9, an encore presentation of Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Republican John Boehner is expected to be the next Speaker of the House. How he wants to change the agenda and the possibilities for working with Tea Party-backed members and the Obama administration.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about preservation of mid-20th century architecture today with one of the experts in the field, Dr. Theodore Perdone, is an architect, teaches preservation at Columbia University at the Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. He also has, as I'm told, the single most important and the first book that really talks about this, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Diane Althaus is Executive Director of Historic Charlotte, and Ken Lambla, I usually inflate people's titles, but I deflated yours, so let me get it right this time. He's the Dean of the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte. You were talking just prior to the break about three prominent Charlottean architects, Odell, Pease, and Boyd. Some of them went away and came back, as you said, to build a new South City. And that in and of itself seems to me to gives this style of architecture some heft above and beyond what it might have in another city, because it was put here precisely to do what we have become.
That's exactly right. I was trying to emphasize the point Diane was making about this architecture being particular to Charlotte in response to those people who think that Charlotte doesn't have a unique identity. These individuals understand sort of the cultural imperative of building a new city in the 50s and 60s.
And what was that imperative?
That imperative was about commerce. It was about the transition from the mill heritage of Charlotte to a thriving economic entity. Mm-hmm. It was about demographic change, the influx of a new population, not just from the rural areas, but from various other parts of the United States. Mm-hmm. And it really was a design on a city. Mm-hmm. I can't comment on whether or not it was all about competing with Atlanta, although that's common mythology. But I think it was a response to the local condition. And so when you see in the 1940s Odell leading the charge to create a planning commission, for example, it was an understanding that these decisions about city building were systematic and that they were engaged with the unique fabric of this place. Hmm. So he understood. Now there, my colleague Dan Morrill will be out there cringing, thinking about the removal of Brooklyn, for example. And I understand that, but.
For people who don't know, Brooklyn is where Second Ward is today. It's where the Blake Hotel is today. It's where Aquatic Center is today.
Right.
It was an African American neighborhood in the center core of the city.
Right. But there was a sense of renewal, rejuvenation, energy, and courage, to come back to that word I used.
Okay. I don't remember the fellow's name, but back in the 1980s, a very famous architect was brought to town to make a presentation, and they walked him through the streets. Now, this is before the...
That was Robert Stern, by the way,
okay.
Who's currently dean of the School of Architecture at Yale.
Well, he walked through the streets of Charlotte, and this is before the Bank of America Tower that stands there now. It's before the Wachovia Tower, First Union Tower, was built. It was basically steel frame and glass buildings. Why? 20th century architecture. And he had very, very, very unflattering things to say about the look of downtown and the style of architecture and the buildings. Was he wrong? Because the downtown core has completely changed, and I will bet you much of that came from those comments.
Well, I think that I was living in Charlotte at the time. I had just moved to Charlotte in 1983, and I think he came in 84, 85. I think his comments were a good touchstone for understanding the issues of scale and landscape in the city. And what he didn't understand is that we were in the process, and through the leadership of people like Harvey Gantt and other architects, we were in the process of completely transforming the urban landscape in downtown Charlotte. Mm. It started in 84, to be precise. And so I think, you know, we are not sitting here trying to represent all modernist buildings as being good mm-hmm. and having attributes that could be associated with European modernism. But there is a recognition, as Diane and Teo have pointed out, that without having this conversation, we'll lose all of that. And then where will we be? Where will we be?
Now, just a moment ago, Diane Althaus mentioned that 50 years seems to be the point at which you can designate something as being historically significant. And you, Dr. Prudhon, say that the rule, that 50-year standard, should be replaced by a 30-year rule. That's really difficult to wrap my head around. How can something be historically significant when it was built 30 years ago, 1980? I have socks older than that.
I'm not sure how to take that. I mean, your socks. I think it's comes from a different thinking process. The 50-year rule is an arbitrary date. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the origin is. Some people say it comes out of the custom laws in the early 20th century when they tried to define the word antique. But I think what happens is that when buildings become about 30 years, they go into a gray zone. There is this transition zone, both in terms of generations and in terms of appearance, that makes it vulnerable. And so I think back to Diane's comment, the idea by moving the line a little bit, we buy ourselves time to make the right selection. Because I think what's different about preservation now than it was, let's say, 50 years ago, I'm using the word 50, is looking at what we are going to save, not what we are having to save because it's going to be demolished. Hmm. So we select, we look forward. We look forward rather than backward.
Once again, not all of these buildings that were built between 1940 and the 1970s are historically significant. And let's talk about how you make these decisions, how you walk around town and decide that's something we need to save or that's something that we can let go. How do we make that decision? Is it simply based on the architecture? Is it based on the original use or the current use of the building? Is it based on the people who designed and built it, the people who used it, an event that happened there? I mean, Elvis was at the Coliseum. The Coliseum is on your list. Is that something we should save because Elvis was there?
The answer to your question is it's some or all of those things. It's not just the building. You also want to tie it to some, it could be a historic event. You know, you've all heard, you know, George Washington slept here. It could be a famous person was born there or there is a famous architect that's become, you know, sort of iconic like Odell is in Charlotte. So what we look for are enough of those reasons to say this building plus these other reasons, qualifies as being a landmark in Charlotte or being listed on the National Register. There's a pretty lengthy process that goes into making this all happen, including, you know, if it's a local landmark approval by the City Council, if it's approved on the National Register, you go through the State Historic Preservation Office in Raleigh. There's a whole report that's written up, and then it goes up to the Park Service, and they have to approve it. And it's not done without a lot of study. So that's what we do, I guess, as preservationists, is document and research those particular buildings or neighborhoods mm-hmm. and say this is what we think is significant. Just much like Wilmore, which was just made our sixth local historic district, huge process, 600 homes. I mean, it's really a whole process of kind of proving the case, if you will.
And who are you proving it to?
Well, we're proving it to the local landmarks commission mm-hmm. at times, sometimes the local historic district. We have to go to Raleigh to the State Historic Preservation Office, and they review the reports and make sure that what we're saying is true and accurate and stands out. And then the National Park Service has to get involved if it's going to be a National Register.
How much of it is subjective and how much of it is not? Is it all subjective? Is it just based on personal taste and expertise?
I mean, you guys can help me out. I think it's a combination of the facts of the date, the location, the architect, the style. You know, is it unique? Is it something that it might be the last good example of a particular thing? Or is it a collection of buildings that, you know, have special significance? So it's a combination of things. And, you know, history is somewhat subjective, so you could say that.
How many of these buildings have we already lost that perhaps should have been saved in Charlotte? Does anybody know?
I don't think we have a list, if okay. you will. But there's certainly buildings that it would have been nice to see still standing in Uptown Charlotte. One might be the Carnegie Library, which was this big Beaux-Arts confection.
Right down the street.
Right down the street. Also, the Masonic Temple, which, you know, was in Trade and Tryon, and Egyptian Revival in Charlotte, North Carolina.
I remember when that one went away. Why did we lose the Carnegie Library? Had it simply outlived its usefulness as a library? I mean, the architecture itself, it seems to me, would have saved it, but it didn't. Why?
You know, I don't know. I wasn't here, so.
Okay. You have said at Historic Charlotte that this city has a treasure trove of significant modern buildings. Are they mostly commercial? Are they residential? Combination of the two?
It's a combination of the two. We've already landmarked some of these buildings. I say we because there are lots of other people that are involved in that. The Colosseum, Ovens Auditorium, those are two kind of recent examples of buildings that have been landmarked that are from this particular era.
Let's talk about those buildings, because I have a list of those buildings that you have kind of pointed out as being worthy. Ovens Auditorium, the original Charlotte Coliseum, mm-hmm. the building in which we are now sitting, Spirit Square, the original Wachovia building on Trade, the Cutter building. I'm not sure where that is.
The Cutter building is at the corner of 4th and Tryon, and there's two buildings that look very similar across the street from each other, mm-hmm. and they're both sort of modeled after the Lever House in New York.
Okay.
Both of those buildings in form are really wonderful modern buildings, but they've both been reskinned, if you will. So they wouldn't qualify because of that for any kind of landmark status, but they were very unique designs in Uptown Charlotte at the time.
And Garinger High School.
And that has been landmarked.
So let's talk about each of these buildings and what makes them worth saving. And let's begin with a place that is near and not dear to my heart. Not near and not dear to my heart. Ovens Auditorium.
Okay.
If there was ever a barn, that's it.
And you say that as a performance space?
Yeah, as a performance space.
Well, it's an Odell building, as we've mentioned, and both of those buildings were built, the Coliseum and the Ovens Auditorium were built at a time when Charlotte was expanding out Independence. Mm-hmm. It was great forethought that we thought that the city would expand out that way. Mm-hmm. And it was a way to draw people from the city center out toward, you know, this whole concept of the suburb.
And as a municipal auditorium, it serves that purpose. Mm-hmm. But it's a purpose that perhaps time has moved beyond. No? Yes? Maybe? You're looking at me like the daggers in my head.
Well, I think it's a still very viable building, and it's still used for its original purpose.
Yeah, but it's a terrible space.
Why is it terrible?
Acoustically and the way the seating is set up. And
well, but I think if you look at what's happening to 1950s and 1960s auditorium worldwide, all of them are being revisited for a couple of different reasons. One is acoustics, because the perception or the knowledge about acoustics in the 60s was very different, mm-hmm. but also our performances have changed. If
right.
you look at the sea and the number and amount of equipment that people bring in to do performances these days, which is compared to 1955, is inconceivable. So renovation of a major public auditoriums and theaters is actually ongoing right now in most major cities in the world, whether it's Sydney, London,
and they've done an interior renovation of it. It's much nicer looking.
I can't comment. I haven't
seen it
yet.
But I
think there's, if you look at it from a period point of view, mm-hmm. there is that enormous shift. Avery Fisher in New York is, I think, in its third acoustical mm-hmm. phase because of the perception change and the knowledge changes and the needs we have.
Okay.
So the adaptation is there. It doesn't necessarily detract from the quality of the building.
The original Coliseum on Independence as part of that grouping of buildings is also on your list, and unlike the second Coliseum, which met the wrecking ball about 10 minutes after it was built, this is still here and still being used for the original purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that significant?
Well, do you want to talk about the architecture?
Because of the dome?
Go ahead.
Well, the dome is, at the time, it was one of the largest freestanding domes
anywhere
in the southeast. And it's an Odell building, and it's been part of the cultural landscape and an active part of the cultural landscape since it was built.
And it seems to have been able to find its... I don't go to a lot of
checkers
games, but...
I don't think they play there anymore.
Well, whoever plays there, it seems to be able... It's sized correctly for the people who come to that to those kinds of events. Am I wrong or right?
Well, at the time,
so
it was the largest possible space. And now with everything being built so much larger, it's the right size for certain kinds of events. So it seems to be doing very well.
Spirit Square is on the list. And I was really shocked that this would be on the list of modern or mid-century buildings. Why is Spirit Square on that list?
Well, I'm gonna turn this over to Teo to address another aspect of this conversation we've been having, but one of them obviously is the cultural significance of the transformation of the First Baptist Church into the McLuhan Theater, which really houses two or three distinct layers of Charlotte's history and the kind of congregation that the space represents. But Spirit Square is also in that peculiar genre of postmodern architecture that I know Teo wants to talk about.
Okay.
Well, I think they're sort of, first of all, I think that it is a classic example of a building that, in my mind, goes into the gray zone. I mean, it's been there long enough, but we are not yet there to respect it for what it represents. It's too close to us. And it is the next generation. I think if we're now worrying about preserving modernism, I have no doubt, and I think we're already talking about it, how we're going to preserve postmodernism. And if you walk into your lobby, you look at your columns, those are quintessential examples of architecture of the early 1980s. And that's almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And so it's coming. And maybe it may not be close to us, but it's coming.
So when you talk about Spirit Square, you're talking about this whole complex, not just the part of it that was the Baptist Church and that houses two theaters. You're talking about the office space, the studio, etc. This used to be a restaurant where we're sitting right. This used to be the Pewter Rose.
Then before that, it was actually the Baptist Church Annex,
okay.
And they had Sunday school here.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the building as a whole.
Yes.
Because there was, before the crash, before the recession, there was talk about tearing all of this down and replacing it with a new mixed-used arts complex. That, in your mind, would have been a bad thing to do?
I think it would have been seriously worth considering saving the building.
The whole building or just the theater part?
No, I don't know the complex well enough to pass the judgment. But I think conceptually it would be looking at what it represents within the cultural community as well as in the physical community.
Well, I was on the steering committee that the Arts and Science Council put together to study that, and we never reached any real firm conclusion. But one of the positive outcomes is that we started looking more carefully, studying this building and its various parts, but also its various periods. And one of the other aspects that I think was very positive was to look at it in relationship to the main library structure. So, and that building is also a 1980s building.
Right.
So we are looking at now a concept that moves the preservation movement away from individual structures into a whole block, and therefore the city fabric itself.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about examples of mid-20th century architecture, not only downtown, but in residential areas, with our three guests in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Moore and Van Allen, a law firm known for taking on complex cases and providing proactive legal counsel. Moore and Van Allen attorneys help clients compete in the Carolinas nationally and abroad. MVALaw.com. And Sardis Baptist Church, an inclusive congregation where women are pastors, children lead worship, and theological diversity is valued. 5811 Sardis Road or online at sardisbaptistcharlotte.org. Ohio Congressman John Boehner is expected to be the next Speaker of the House. A panel of journalists joins Diane Rehm to talk about the challenges he faces within the Republican Party and the possibilities for compromise with the Obama administration. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE. That's 93-23, by the way. Or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
WFAE invites you to enter to win an Escape for Two, courtesy of the Pinehurst Resort in the North Carolina Sandhills. You can enjoy elegant accommodations, historic golf courses, spa therapies, and fine dining. No pledge is necessary to enter. The winner will be notified by email. Details at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting in an historic landmark, Spirit Square, today with Diane Althaus, Executive Director of Historic Charlotte, Dr. Ken Lambla, Dean of the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Teo Prudhon, architect who teaches preservation at Columbia University Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation, the author of Preservation of Modern Architecture, which is widely regarded as the preeminent book on the topic, and the founding president of DocoMoMo US, the Documentation of Conservation of Building Sites and Neighborhoods of the Modern Movement. I'm going to take a phone call here, so put your headphones on, if you would, and we'll hear from Andrew in Charlotte. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning.
I have a question for Diane. My house was built in the 60s by Alan Tate. When we went to renovate the house a few years ago, I asked my builder to match the exterior brick, and he looked at me and he said, Andrew, they don't make 200-year-old brick anymore. And what he was saying was that Alan Tate apparently used recycled bricks when he constructed my house. And apparently, in the 60s, this was fairly common, that they were destroying some buildings downtown, just chipping off the mortar and shipping the bricks wholesale out to the neighborhood. And I started looking around, and sure enough, there are several houses in my neighborhood where I can tell he used some of this old brick. I'm wondering, I always thought that Charlotte's growth was really always moving out to the suburbs, but I'm wondering if there was really a period in time, kind of like we're seeing today, where they just cleared out areas and then rebuilt, bringing in new buildings. I'm wondering if during the 60s there was a big movement downtown to clear out some of these old buildings and bring in some new ones.
Anybody know?
All I can say is that there is clearly a period in American history, particularly in the 60s and 70s, where urban renewal, which was an attempt to clear areas that were less economically viable or perceived to be less economically viable, and replace them with whatever was the plan at the time. And of course, part of what we are talking now in preservation is always looking back at that urban renewal and trying to sort out what we feel about it. And I think that that's probably something like that happened, whereby part of the economic development, social housing, and whatever else was the driving force would have been resulted in demolishing of certain areas.
I'm not sure anybody was here in the 1960s. Were you here in the 1960s?
No.
Does Historic Charlotte keep up with the 1960s? Do you know what happened or didn't happen in the 1960s? If you look back in your archive, you may not know personally, but could you find that out?
Well, it's interesting. I've never heard of someone, never heard of these bricks being reused, but I like the concept.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the problems with all the demolition that takes place is everything ends up in a landfill. So the fact that someone was recycling brick from uptown to build these new neighborhoods is interesting, but I hadn't heard that before.
Andrew, thank you for your call. Conrad on Facebook writes, I have the fortune of living in a mid-century atomic ranch, much smaller than most of the McMansions that were so popular in Charlotte, but all of the space is utilized. We did a whole program. It's in the deep, dark recesses of my mind. We did a whole program about this kind of architecture in Charlotte, residential architecture.
Right. We were on the air about 2 years ago, just before our mid-century modern home tour.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the houses we had on the tour was an atomic ranch. And it was actually one of the most popular houses on the tour. So, you know, small is beautiful, and it was really fun to have that.
And you believe, your organization, DocoMoMo, Dr. Pruden, believes that the greatest loss of modernist architecture is post-World War II single-family residences, because they are in prime locations and are, in contemporary terms, not large enough or comfortable enough. If that's truly the case, how do you save them? How do you reverse it? How do you keep them going?
Well, I think that you've got to keep in mind that if you look at the size of the average single-family home over the last 50 years, it's sort of probably tripled or doubled or whatever that number is. So that really we are looking at much greater needs. I think there is a whole generation of those mid-century houses that have been very carefully, very thoughtfully extended, and not necessarily wholesale development. And I think part of what people need to begin to appreciate is what the architectural context is for the house, and that it actually is a very thoughtful house. And if you is thoughtfully extended, there's no reason to turn it down.
This move, we are being told that there's now a move toward downsizing, that people don't want these grand three-story foyers that waste heat and air conditioning, etc., that they want to have something more reasonable and more economical. Is this going to save these houses? Is this going to make these houses more appealing all of a sudden?
Well, I think it's a factor, and I also think you have a lot of baby boomers who are retiring and downsizing.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably have a comfort zone with some of these kind of houses because they grew up in them.
Grew up in, yeah.
And, yeah, they're one level generally. They have a lot of light, which as you get older is really important. And you know, you're talking about why some of these houses are endangered. When they were built, they might have been a small footprint, mm-hmm. but a lot of them are on half an acre, you know, a third of an acre or more. And so that makes the lot very desirable for developers because they can put a really big house on it.
Well, yes. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. It may make it appealing, but also make it appealing to the developers to tear it down
exactly.
and do a new house. Well, we're in this period of recession.
Mm-hmm.
Is that helping historic preservation in general and this kind of preservation in particular? Because there's not a lot of development going on, and growth is pretty much stopped. It gives you a chance to assess, to breathe.
I think so. I mean, it's probably the only tiny silver lining of what's going on, but I have definitely noticed many fewer demolitions than there were in, you know, starting 2 years ago and back. It was just everywhere. So it's definitely had an impact. And I also think a lot of people, after that all stopped, kind of looked back at the last 10 years of incredible growth here and had a moment of, like, you know, some of it's great, but a lot of it is, what did we do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why did we build the things that we built at that particular time?
And in the way we built them and the way we designed the infrastructure around them. Dr. Lamblet at UNC Charlotte, in addition to Dr. Pruden's visit today, is hosting an exhibit at the School of Architecture called Modernism at Risk. And these risks don't simply come from the wrecking ball. There are other threats as well. What are they?
Well, I think, firstly, we should talk about the change of context for these buildings. I think your question about Ovens Auditorium is a question of context. It was at one time a kind of lifeline out to those public facilities, and now it's just become the edge of a major highway. So one of the risks is the way in which the context changes. I think the other risk that you actually alluded to in regard to the residential examples is the cost of operation and maintenance. I think we are seeing in the profession of architecture a dramatic increase in preservation, restoration, renovation, adaptive reuse projects, which, frankly, is a more sustainable practice in many ways.
Hmm.
We are not going to be building as much new building, and so we need to learn how to bring these buildings back to life, if you will. And find new uses for them. So I think some of those both external and internal consequences are playing out.
What role do things like apathy and inappropriate alterations to the original structure, as you mentioned with the Cutter building, what role do they play in putting these buildings at risk? If they don't look like what they were to begin with, then we can't have an appreciation for what they are or what they could be if we took off the skin.
I think that's probably one of the biggest problems for every preservation of any building. I think that's not necessarily limited to modern buildings,
mm-hmm.
but I think that, and also to appreciate how innovative they were. I always show my students images of Lever House on Park Avenue in 1955. Everything was masonry, Beaux-Arts, residential, and there suddenly is this shiny, white, light-colored, metal and glass building owned by a soap company. And so you can see the significance of it in that photograph is very clear, and you can see why what you're going to do to the outside and the upper and the repair of it is very important. But I think at the end of the day, it comes back to ownership. How significant does ownership think the building is? And most of the successful preservations has been because ownership feels that it's part of the identity of the building.
Hmm. Conrad, writing on Facebook again, has come to the defense of Ovens Auditorium. He says, I disagree with Mike's assessment of Ovens. As a former music engineer and producer, I find the shows there to have the greatest acoustics along with Spirit Square in the city. Okay, Conrad. I want your ears. And we had a caller who couldn't hold that wondered if there are existing tours of this kind of architecture in Charlotte, or if, I guess, Historic Charlotte is willing to set one up. I think you do tours of this architecture.
We're actually planning our second mid-century modern home tour for next May. So we'll be having all the information on our website by January. And, you know, we had 18 homes the first time we did the tour, which in hindsight was probably too many. But, you know, we could have had twice that because people got very excited and wanted their home on the tour. And this coming May, we'll probably have more like 10 or 12. But I don't think it's going to be very difficult to find the homes because people are very house proud of these homes. You know, when we did the tour, a lot of people said, thank you. You know, we've been looking for some recognition for a long time. And, you know, Ken was talking a little bit earlier about mid-century modern architecture, especially with the homes. There's also this design element of the furniture and the kind of things you put in the home, which seems very popular again. It's you know, just as everything has a popularity continuum,
yeah.
Mid-century modern has, I think, kind of hit its bottom, and it's coming back. We work with a woman that owns Modern Charlotte. It's a local realtor that just does modern homes. And she said she had one of her best years ever this last year.
Really?
So to be in the real estate market and say these homes are selling is really interesting. But I think it's because they're special, and maybe it's because we have a lot of folks moving in from California because of one of the banks. And it's good to hear.
Is Mad Men helping?
I think, you know, we were laughing about that earlier.
I think Mad Men is a representation of the fact we're interested in the period again.
Uh-huh.
It started out with collecting furniture. If you look at the prices of furniture in the last 20 years for that period, they have, again, quadrupled. And so I think that is the transfer of the furniture to the building is probably the process that is taking place.
Interesting. Phil in Charlotte writes, my name is Phil Reed. I hold an undergraduate and graduate degree from UNCC's College of Architecture. Ken will recognize my name and expect my comments to be at least a bit contrarian. What you have been discussing hasn't yet addressed the larger issue of why architecture is broadly failing our culture. This discussion represents the deep and unfortunate politicization of architecture over the past 50 years. If only architects had dedicated themselves more to principles of elegant design than the principles of politics, then we'd have designs worth saving. This lesson is being missed. You're right about Ovens Auditorium being a barn. Saving it because it came from Odell's sleeves is an insidious form of racism. The best thing we can do is tear it down as an example to future architects and architectural students what will happen to their sloppy efforts. In other words, studying politics at the expense of studying design. Your eyes are crossing.
We're definitely going to let Ken answer that.
Good to hear Phil's voice. You could substitute the word for education for architecture and make the same argument that once any cultural phenomenon that's alive, that goes through change on a regular basis, becomes a kind of political basketball, falls prey to being evaluated out of context. And I certainly don't think architecture in any way, shape, or form has been diminished in its cultural significance. Certainly, Charlotte has embraced architecture with a lot more of a robust attention in the last 10 years. I only have to point to the cultural campus, the kind of national and international kind of attention to those facilities as buildings, but also as the cultural enrichment of Charlotte. UNC Charlotte's new building in First Ward by Kieran Timberlake and Gant Huberman is another example that I think represents the success of architecture being integrated into a city's evolution. So it would only be consistent of me to argue back to Phil.
Okay. Let's go to Cornelius. Jim, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
I went through UNCC College of Architecture in the late 70s when modernism was trying to be phased out in case of modern art, postmodern. And it left us scratching our heads at that time as to where we were going and what we were doing. And it took me probably 20 years to coalesce my own feelings and that the function of modernity, which modern architecture about with no adornment, was the right direction.
Jim, try to stand very still because you're in a very bad cell.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
And postmodern was simply slapping on some decoration is the Chippendale building in New York. And it, like I said, it's been that long to get there. And what I found works for me is the function of the building compatibly blended with the aesthetic feeling to those people. And
Jim, I'm sorry. We're missing every other syllable. I'm very sorry. We were completely out of time. Otherwise, I'd tell you to call back on a landline. Did any of you get anything from that? You did not. Okay. Just like practitioners, I'm sorry, Jim, just like practitioners of any art form, architects are probably ahead of the curve for those people who are lay people and don't study this and don't follow it very, very well. So you see value in things that we don't yet. We may lag you by 50 years. So how do you get us to buy into this?
Education. Education is the core of it, education at all levels. And we've been talking about graduate education primarily in terms of UNCC, but I think part of what we teach our children and our high school students is part of that whole process of understanding history and what the built environment. And I think I would advocate everybody going to an Italian kindergarten school where even all the pencils are lined up and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so I have this illusion that all these kids come out thinking about things that are beautiful. And I think if once we begin to teach people in general that, I think there's hope.
The Italians get design, don't they?
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Teo Perdone, architect teaching at Columbia University and the author of Preservation of Modern Architecture. Diane Althaus is executive director of Historic Charlotte. And Ken Lambla is dean of the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.